normal. I'm cracking open my vacuum-sealed packs and getting the hell out of Miami. Pinky, don't. We have to hold it together here. Bullshit. Your brother-in-law is stuffing coke up his nose and dropping money at strip clubs like there's holes in his pockets. He's wearing a target on his chest. Either you get him to tone it down, or I might take some target practice myself. That's not cool. Jeffrey is your nephew. He's a fuck-up. This is the big leagues. There's a chance Marco didn't give us up. But if somebody even twists Jeffrey's fat finger, there's no chance he won't give us up. You gotta take control of the situation. If you don't, I will. Don't threaten me. No threat. Here's the deal. Get Fatso under control, and we split Marcos's share. Otherwise, I keep it. That's all I have to say. Pinky hung up. Reuben tossed the cell onto the passenger seat. Week one had been a dream. Week two was shaping up to be a nightmare. Pinky's question had hit the nail on the head. What? You don't trust me, bro? Reuben didn't trust anybody. Gotta take control. He started the engine and nearly ran over the homeless guy as he backed out of the parking spot. The driver's side window squeaked as he lowered it. Dog bless you, he said as he drove away. Chapter 11. Andy stopped by Littleford's townhouse after dinner. It had been a busy afternoon, and his place was on her way home from the crime lab. Tire tracks match, said Andy. The pickup used in the heist was definitely inside the delivery truck at some point in time. They were seated in matching Adirondack chairs on the backyard patio. The sun had set, and a half moon was rising over the tall ficus hedge. It was the peak of autumn in South Florida, that one night each November when Miamians step out of their air-conditioned boxes and ask, "Hey, where did the humidity go?"
That gives us something, said Littleford. Stay on Tomcat this week to keep looking for the pickup, but my bet is that it's probably cruising down the streets of Nassau or Santo Domingo as we speak.
Or chopped into pieces that will soon be sprinkled across South America.
What about the finger?
More bad news. No fingerprint.
Ants?
Not just ants, dermestids, flesh-eating beetles. Every trace of epidermis is gone. I swear you find the most bizarre insects at these cargo terminals on the river.
What'd you find out about the blood on the chains?
Be positive. It matches the DNA from the finger. Male victim. Unfortunately, we have nothing from the MIA warehouse to compare it to, so no way to know if it was one of the perps in the heist.
Any other prints to work with?
MDPD pulled some from the handwritten note that was found under the visor and from the cab of the delivery truck, but no hits in the databases. Littleford's wife came out and handed him a slice of cheesecake on a plate. You sure you wouldn't like some, Andy? She asked. I'm fine, thank you.
You know, dessert is actually a required activity in my unit, said Littleford.
You do make it tempting, but my plan is still a steady diet of undercover work after this case is cracked. He shaved off a slice with his fork and savored it.
Great cake, Barbara.
Thanks, honey, she said. Do you bake, Andy? Only when I lie in the sun. Excuse me? Sorry, bad joke. No, I'm not much of a cook.
But she can shoot the cap off a Coke bottle at 50 yards, said Littleford.
It was a slight exaggeration, but Barbara didn't seem impressed anyway. Michael says you moved here from Seattle. That's right, said Andy. Are you seeing anyone?
Hey, a new world record, said Littleford. 15 seconds until Barbara puts out the feelers for her poor, lonely, divorced cousin.
Stop, Michael. John is not poor.
I didn't mean he's... I know what you both mean, said Andy. No, I'm not dating anyone. But I'm not looking to date right now. Thank you, though.
Great answer, said Littlefort.
Barbara rose.
Well, if you change your mind, I'll let you know, said Andy.
Barbara smiled and left them alone. Littlefort set his plate on the armrest.
Well, wasn't that just dandy? I spent all week trying to convince you to stay in the bank robbery unit, and in 2 minutes, my wife has you running for undercover work.
Andy laughed.
Don't worry about it.
Okay, let's talk about this week. I want you to coordinate with MDPD to find out who lost a finger.
No problem.
Any reason to go back to the MIA warehouse? Andy considered it.
I still think one of the guards, probably Alvarez, called the perps from the warehouse and told them when to come. But we've practically turned that warehouse inside out looking for a phone. Nothing.
Your initial reaction is probably spot on, said Littlefort. He went into the bathroom, made the call, smashed the phone into 1,000 tiny pieces, and flushed it down the toilet.
We should keep our eye on Alvarez. At some point, he needs to meet up with someone and get his cut of the stolen money.
Unless someone else is putting the money through the laundry and it ends up in his Cayman Islands account. Maybe we go back to Braxton and talk to Alvarez again.
Littleford's wife was back with 2 demitasses.
Espresso?
She asked.
Is it decaf?
Asked Andy.
Littlefort made a face. Real dessert, real coffee. Get with the program, Henning.
Andy smiled and took the cup.
I forgot to ask, said Barbara. How do you feel about lawyers?
Barbara, give it a rest, said Littlefort.
Sorry.
She went back inside.
My wife has a great heart, but she's one of those married people who will never rest until the rest of the world is married, too.
Andy felt the need to shift gears. She opted for the perfect diversion with any man and made the conversation about him.
Not to change the subject, but ever since those interviews at Braxton, I've been meaning to say that I love the way you worked in those 18 robberies in 3 days after the Lufthansa heist at JFK. I thought you were bluffing, but I Googled it. That was no bull.
Nope. August 1979.
So your dad was with NYPD?
No, that part of the story I made up.
Are you kidding me?
No, he was never even a cop.
Oh, man, she said, smiling. You had me totally buying it. What did he do? Wait, don't tell me. Aromatherapist, right?
He smiled, then turned serious. He drove an armored truck in the Bronx.
For real? Why didn't you tell the folks at Braxton?
He shook his head. I don't really tell anyone.
Andy paused, confused, not sure why he'd be embarrassed by it.
Why not?
You really want to know?
She wasn't sure.
Yeah, if you want to tell me.
He put down his demitasse and looked out across the yard as he spoke.
It happened on a Tuesday, he said. I was in my last week of the third grade and couldn't wait to start summer vacation. My dad was in the parking lot outside a shopping center. 4 men stormed the truck. 2 of them had guns. They got away with $292,000. No one really knows why, but they shot both guards before they ran off with the money. 1 lived. Dad was dead before I got home from school.
Andy didn't know what to say. I'm so sorry.
I had no idea.
It's okay. I don't really talk about it, especially with the armored transport companies. Can you imagine what they would say? Oh, there goes Littleford again, bumping up the reward money, still trying to make us pay for never finding out who killed his daddy. Andy studied his profile, which was more like a silhouette in the dim afterglow of the sunset. Did they offer a reward? Sure did.
I'm going to take a guess here, she said. Was it good only for information leading to an arrest, conviction, and return of the money?
Finally, he looked at her. Smart girl. Andy sat forward in her chair and spoke without so much as a blink of her eyes.
We're going to catch these guys.
He looked off again toward the long shadows on the lawn. Yeah, he said quietly. I know we will. Chapter 12. Jeffrey Beauchamp was in celebration mode. It was the 1 week anniversary of his becoming a millionaire. His pockets were stuffed with money, his nostrils were numb from coke, and the perfect ass of one of his favorite porn stars was grinding down on him in a 4 minute lap dance.
Easy, baby, he said.
Oh, Jeffy, you naughty boy. I knew there was a dick somewhere under that big belly.
The men at the next table laughed. So did Jeffrey. The lap dance was a well-honed art form at the Gold Rush in downtown Miami. Completely naked women worked on very drunk men, and the old song about a fool and his money was perpetually at the top of the charts. Many a hungover patron had awakened the morning after to find that the same $5 cocktails he bought for himself were $50 when purchased for a dancer, and that the love of his life, who couldn't say enough about the enormous bulge in his pants, had mistakenly charged him $1,200 for a $100 dance.
Oops, sorry, sweetie.
Dancers were from all over the world, Thailand to India, London to Sao Paulo, and Caribbean goddesses galore. The biggest draw was the weekly headliner, usually a porn star of some note. Most customers were from out of town, save for a handful of regulars that included a former congressman and an ex-state attorney who'd lost his job after flashing his badge to get in without a cover charge, and Jeffrey. Don't you ever go home, Beauchamp? He smiled. Lap dances 24/7, legs and eggs for breakfast, grilled chicken and a side of friction for lunch.
This is my home.
The music got louder. Bambi worked her ass to a more strategic position, slow and steady.
Jeffy.
His head rolled back, and the mirror on the ceiling offered a bird's eye view of Bambi at her bouncy best.
What?
Can I get a Rolex?
Okay.
One with diamonds?
Uh-huh.
I want it right now.
Okay.
Bambi slid off his lap. Jeffrey knocked back another shot of tequila and pushed himself up from his chair. Half of his ass was hanging out of the back of his pants, and he could feel the cold air on his skin. But he didn't care. He wiped away the coke residue from under his nose, and Bambi followed him past the line of pole dancers and across the bar to a dark booth in the back. Sully was with a pair of Venezuelan strippers. Jeffrey recognized one, but the other girl was new. He liked the snake tattoo coiling up her arm. Very hot.
What?
Jeffrey started to say, but the words wouldn't come. That last shot of tequila had hit him like a mule kick. He tried again.
What happened to your ear, bro?
Sully tugged at the bandage. It's my Vincent Van Gogh look.
Huh?
Nothing. You need another Rolex? Bambi nodded.
Jeffy said I could have one.
Sully snapped his fingers at the new girl with the snake tattoo. The Rolex was the only thing she was wearing, and it made her pout to hand it over.
You like this one?
Sully asked as he handed it to Bambi. She stepped up on the table and pressed the watch against her pubic hair.
You like it, Jeffy?
She was so close, so in his face, that he had her scent.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it.
$25,000, said Sully.
Put in my account, said Jeffrey.
No, said Sully. No more account.
Why?
That's my new rule. Cash on delivery.
Bambi turned around, bent over, and grabbed her ankles to give Jeffrey his favorite view.
Please, Jeffy.
Okay. Cash, said Jeffrey. My car.
Let's go, said Sully. Excuse us, ladies.
Sully slid out of the booth. Jeffrey staggered past the pole dancers and toward the door. The girl with the snake tattoo followed.
Hey, Jeffy, she said. I like watches, too.
Reuben was sinking deep into the couch, a wink away from sleep, when Savannah shoved him. The 10 o'clock news was on the television.
They think they found the truck that was used in the heist, she said, her voice filled with urgency.
He sat up and got his bearings. The report was nearly over. But a final image of a delivery truck flashed on the screen. He was relieved not to see the pickup, but that was not something to share with Savannah.
That could be.
The reporter reminded viewers to call Crime Stoppers tip line if they have any information about the possible victim, and the newscast moved to the night's next story.
They found a human finger in it, said Savannah.
Reuben wasn't sure what to make of that, but he was concerned enough to prod Savannah for more details.
Did they say anything about a black pickup?
No. What do you know about a black pickup?
Jeffrey told me, he said.
Savannah moved closer, her nails digging into his forearm.
Do you think that finger could be my uncle's?
No,
he said, thinking up another lie on the fly.
Pinky said they hired someone to get rid of the truck. I suppose it could be that guy.
Oh, my God, Reuben. This is the kind of thing I was afraid of. We need to go to the police.
Just calm down.
His phone rang and it made them both jump. Keep an eye on the news and see if there's any update, he told Savannah. Then he stepped away to take the call where she couldn't overhear. The voice on the line was Jamaican.
Reuben, you got big trouble, man.
It was the bartender at the Gold Rush. He used to work with Reuben at the restaurant. Reuben should never have backed down on burying Jeffrey's entire share in his yard, but $100 a night for Ramsey to keep an eye on Jeffrey was Reuben's finger on the pulse of a bad situation.
What now? He asked.
Your brother-in-law is out of control, man. Totally out of control.
Reuben cut one last glance toward Savannah before ducking into the kitchen. She was glued to the television, waiting for any follow-up on the heist.
Tell me, he said into the phone.
He's crazy, man. Money, coke, girls. Tonight he's buying Rolex watches for the strippers.
What?
Reuben, I don't know where Jeffrey gets this money. Not my business. But if the cash don't run out soon, he going to end up dead in the parking lot.
Reuben started to pace back and forth from the stove to the refrigerator.
That's what I've been telling him. I've been telling him and telling him and telling.
You telling him, man, but he ain't listening. You got to do something, or it going to be one revolting situation.
Reuben stopped at the sink, ran his hand through his hair, and let out a mirthless chuckle. The Jamaicans had such a way with words.
You got that right, bro.
One revolting situation.
Reuben woke before 5 a.m., but not on purpose. He thought he heard Savannah on the phone. He buried his head in the pillow and hoped he was dreaming. They'd gone to bed at midnight and not on good terms. Whatever good he'd done by returning the Rolex was lost with the replacement gift. The earrings were on sale at the mall. He'd sworn to her, no funny money involved. Savannah wasn't fooled.
Reuben, wake up!
He opened his eyes. The room was dark and Savannah was practically on top of him. Her cell was pressed to her ear.
Jeffrey's in trouble!
He groaned and rolled onto his side. Savannah tugged his shoulder and forced him to look at her.
He needs to talk to you!
He checked the clock on the nightstand.
I need sleep.
She shoved the phone at him.
He sounds scared to death. Talk to him!
Fine,
he said as he took the phone. Jeffrey, I have no coke. Time to go to bed. Good night. He hung up and tossed the phone aside.
Reuben, what are you doing?
She screamed. The phone rang immediately. Savannah answered, and Reuben could hear the urgency in her voice as she spoke into the phone.
Jeffrey, are you okay? Where are you?
Reuben stayed in the bed, but his wife was up and began to pace at the foot of the bed. Reuben wasn't trying to listen, but she was talking in a loud, excited voice. Her end of the conversation was the same line over and over again.
Oh my God! Oh my God! Oh my God!
Finally, she lowered the phone and spoke to Reuben.
Someone has Jeffrey.
Reuben got up on one elbow.
What do you mean, has him?
Abducted, kidnapped, whatever you want to call it. They took him from the parking lot at Gold Rush.
When?
30 minutes ago.
He fell back into the pillow.
Oh, shit.
Savannah was back on the phone.
Jeffrey, listen to what I'm saying. I want you to do whatever they... Jeffrey! Are you there?
Even in the darkness, Reuben could see the panic in her expression.
He's gone, she said.
She dialed back frantically, then put the phone down.
No answer. Reuben, what are we going to do?
He sat on the edge of the bed. First we calm down. Freaking out will just make things worse.
I need to call the police!
Reuben snatched away the phone before she could dial. We are not going to call the police.
My brother has been kidnapped!
You don't know that he's been kidnapped. Nobody has asked for a ransom. For all you know, he left the Gold Rush with some prostitute who's threatening to kick his ass because he ran out of money.
No, that's not what this is. I could hear it in his voice. This is bad.
This is exactly the thing I warned him and your uncle about when I told them to stash the money. A guy with no job, no money, and no life is asking for trouble if he suddenly starts acting like he's a high roller. The strippers aren't the only ones who take notice.
What money?
You made sure it was buried. All of it.
That's what you told me.
He had told her that the night of the split. Or had he? He wasn't sure. Time to tap dance.
They must have held out on me and stashed some on their own.
My point is that we're talking about my brother. We have to help him.
Yes, and I'm looking out for him. If we call the cops, this whole heist that he and Pinky pulled off will unravel. Jeffrey will spend the rest of his life in jail,
he said, no mention of his own skin.
We have to work this out ourselves.
How?
We wait for him to call back.
Wait?
What if Jeffrey ends up like that guy in the back of the delivery truck? The only thing left of him is a finger. That's not going to happen to Jeffrey.
How do you know that?
Reuben had to dig deep for the answer to that one. Because Jeffrey
has a family who cares about him. And I'm not going to let it happen.
Savannah sat beside him on the edge of the bed. She was staring blankly into the darkness, but her head was resting on his shoulder. He seemed to have chosen the right words.
What are we going to do?
He took her hand.
We go to work like we do every Monday morning. And we wait.
Chapter 13. Savannah had to be at the dry cleaners by 7 a.m. Reuben drove her.
My brother's missing and I'm going to work, she said, staring out the passenger side window. This is crazy.
It was their normal Monday routine. Savannah on her feet behind the counter, hour after hour, smiling and assuring yet another rich wife of Coral Gables that her Hermès gown would no longer smell of Dom Pérignon, caviar, and Chanel No. 5. The restaurant was closed on Mondays, but Reuben still had to show up and tally the weekend receipts.
There's nothing else to do until we hear from Jeffrey. Or his kidnappers.
He didn't say it, but neither did Savannah. But she was thinking it. Constantly. Savannah climbed out of the passenger seat slowly. She hated her job at the cleaners. Marathon shifts behind the counter on Mondays, Fridays, and Saturdays, however, made up for the paltry wages she earned Tuesday through Thursday as a part-time assistant at a daycare center. Nurturing preschoolers was its own reward. Customers at the dry cleaners only made her feel unworthy, even when they were trying to be nice in their own way. Women like Mrs. Willis, third wife to a rich investment banker, who had come in to drop off a killer cocktail dress with a small red wine stain at the hem. She and Savannah were just about the same height and weight, not to mention age.
I don't think it will come out, Savannah had told her.
You sure?
Not without discoloring the fabric, which would be a shame. Such a gorgeous dress. I mean, I would wear it with a little stain like this on it. But that's just me.
Mrs. Trophy wife had reached for her dress, paused, and then pushed it across the counter toward Savannah.
Why don't you keep it, sweetie? I think you'd dress up nicely in it.
The stain had actually come out, no discoloration, good as new. But Savannah never told the customer. It was the closest she'd ever come to stealing. But she'd managed to rationalize it.
Sweetie, dress up nicely. Up your liposuctioned butt, lady.
She was afraid Reuben was starting to engage in the same mental gymnastics, convincing himself that it was okay to buy a Rolex and earrings for his wife with Jeffrey's stolen money. Like the banks don't steal, Savannah. She'd heard him say that many times, too often, especially of late. It was a slippery slope.
Everything is going to be okay, Reuben said from behind the wheel.
She hesitated before closing the car door.
Are you sure?
Definitely.
It's better to wait at work than to sit at home.
You promise to call me as soon as you know anything.
I promise.
She closed the door, and Reuben drove out of the parking lot. Reuben didn't go to work, but to a coffee shop in West Miami, where he had some business with a certain Jamaican bartender. Ramsey Kincaid was waiting for him at an outside table. Reuben joined him, laid an envelope on the table, and pushed it toward Ramsey.
Here's half, he said.
Ramsey tucked the envelope into his fanny pack without bothering to count the money. His dreadlocks were tucked up under a knit cap. A Bob Marley tattoo bulged on his right bicep. He'd come straight from work at the Gold Rush, having pulled the 11-to-7 shift.
How's our board this morning? Asked Reuben.
I don't know. Huh?
Ramsey tore open a pack of sugar. His hand was shaking so badly that more of it ended up on the table than in his coffee.
We got a problem, Mon. A big problem.
Reuben stared at him. They had agreed on the telephone that the best way to get Jeffrey to stop flashing money was to scare the living crap out of him. Ramsey had agreed to do it for $3,000.
Ramsey, I swear, if my brother-in-law OD'd and died on you, I will not, no, no, Jeffrey not dead, man.
Where is he?
I don't know.
Reuben tightened his glare.
Stop saying you don't know and start explaining. It all went fine at first. Jeffrey partied all night, like he do every night. Finally, he leaves at 4 o'clock in the morning. I walk him to his car. He's so wasted that he practically falls into the trunk. My friends, they took him.
Wait a minute, said Reuben.
You didn't go with them?
No, man. I worked till 7 o'clock in the morning.
I paid you $3,000.
You said you would do it. No, man, I said I would get it done. Kidnapping is not my thing. I got you professionals.
Reuben was ready to grab him by the throat.
You idiot! I didn't tell you to bring in more people!
Hold your horses, man. You didn't tell me not to.
Reuben breathed out his anger. Who are your friends?
Not really friends, more like friends of friends.
You don't even know these guys, do you?
Friends of friends, man.
Reuben leaned into the table, pointing his finger as he spoke. Listen to me, Ramsey. You need to get Jeffrey back right now.
Okay, man.
I mean right now.
No problem. Well, maybe there'd be one problem. The ransom.
What the hell are you talking about? There's no ransom.
Your brother-in-law, he got one big mouth, man. Before we even shove him inside the trunk of the car, he's saying shit like, oh, please, 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 Mr. Kidnapper, don't hurt me. I got lots of money. I pay you $1 million.
Reuben's head was about to explode. I hope your friends didn't believe him.
Not my friends, man. Friends of friends.
Whoever.
Do they think Jeffrey actually has $1 million?
They called me 1 hour ago. They want a handsome ransom. Hey, that rhyme.
How big?
I just told you. 1 million.
No way.
Come on, Reuben. This is your brother-in-law.
I'm not paying $1 million ransom. I'm not paying anything.
These are bad dudes, man. They will kill him.
Reuben looked off toward the rush hour traffic, thinking. Then his gaze shifted back to Ramsey. Here's my counteroffer. Tell your friends to let Jeffrey go.
Not my friends, man. Friends of friends.
I don't care who the fuck they are, Ramsey.
You don't understand, man. Bad dudes, very bad.
He leaned forward, his forearms resting on the table, his eyes cutting through the Jamaican like lasers.
Do you know who Jeffrey's uncle is?
Nuh-uh.
Craig Paris. He goes by Pinky.
Ask around about him.
What you telling me, man?
Reuben had no intention of involving Pinky, but it was the best bluff he could come up with.
Tell these bad dudes to let Jeffrey go, or Pinky comes looking for you.
Chapter 14. Reuben left his assistant manager in charge at the restaurant and picked up Savannah at the dry cleaners. It wasn't even lunchtime, and the early pickup made Savannah think the worst.
The tension was written all over her face as she slid into the passenger seat, shut the door, and braced for the unspeakable.
"Please tell me Jeffrey is okay," she said.
The motor was running, but they were still in the strip mall parking lot. People were coming and going from the cleaners and the drugstore, oblivious to the worried-looking woman talking to her husband in the car.
"I'm sure Jeffrey is just fine," said Reuben.
"It sounds like you don't know."
"I only heard from the kidnappers. I didn't talk to Jeffrey."
Her concern heightened.
"They wouldn't let you speak to him?"
"It wasn't like that. They passed a message to me through one of the bartenders at the Gold Rush, a Jamaican guy."
"Is he working with them?"
He couldn't tell Savannah that he'd hired Ramsey and that his plan to scare Jeffrey had backfired. He kept it vague.
"No, I don't think so."
"What's the message?"
"If we want Jeffrey back, the ransom is $1 million.
She sank a little deeper into the passenger seat, her gaze fixed blankly on the dashboard.
"How easy is it for you to dig up $1 million of what they stole?"
"Very easy, if they counted Reuben's share and the $1 million he was holding for Octavio."
"That's putting the cart before the horse. We don't pay $1 million. We negotiate."
She glanced over.
"How do you know it's negotiable?"
"Everything's negotiable.
Reuben, this is a kidnapping, not an eBay auction."
"We can't get emotional about this."
"Not get emotional? This is my brother."
"Take a breath, okay?
Only a fool would hand over $1 million just because some thug says so. Have you ever met the Mendoza family 2 doors down from us? What do they have to do with this?"
"I'm making a point. A couple of months ago, I got to talking with the abuelo when he was out walking the dog. 5 different members of his family were kidnapped before they finally left Medellin. The old man didn't give me specifics, but they never paid the first ransom demand. It was always negotiated down."
"Reuben, this isn't Medellin."
"It's also not Kabul. We're not up against the Taliban or some other lunatics trying to make a religious or political statement. This is all about money. We negotiate."
She considered it, but not for very long. She looked at him from across the console and spoke in a firm voice.
"No."
"No what?"
"No negotiation. If they hurt Jeffrey, I swear I will never forgive you, Reuben. Pay the $1 million.
He chuckled, but not because it was funny.
"Whoa, whoa, whoa.
"Whoa what?" "Only $500,000 of Jeffrey's share was buried in the yard."
"Let's think this through," he said.
"What's there to think about?"
Reuben stared at the steering wheel, searching for something to say other than the truth of the matter. Paying $1 million meant dipping into their share.
Then it came to him.
"Your first instinct was right, Savannah. When I bought you that Rolex, you said, 'We can't touch the money.' But this is different."
"No, it's not.
If we ever have to explain this to the police, they won't care what we spent it on. All they'll know is that we hid the money and $1 million is missing."
Her expression tightened. It was a nervous look, which meant he was getting through to her.
"Okay. Then what do we do?" she asked.
"The way Jeffrey has been burning through money, he clearly has some serious cash stashed away somewhere. We find it and we use it to pay the ransom."
"How is that better?"
"At least we can honestly say that we never touched any of the money that was under our control."
"I guess that makes sense.
But how do we even know where to look?"
"If you were Jeffrey, where would you stash your money?"
"I have no idea,"
Savannah, come on. Your brother is a 32-year-old cokehead who lives with his mother. Apart from the bedroom he's had since middle school, the only world he knows is the gold rush. We can only hope that he didn't stash his money at the strip club.
Really? Where do you think it is?
She sat up and turned, her left shoulder leaning into the seat back.
No, absolutely not. If we start tearing my mother's house apart looking for Jeffrey's money, I'm going to have to tell her that Jeffrey got kidnapped, and she's going to have a heart attack. Literally, she will run for her rosary and drop dead on the floor.
She is not going to die. We cannot drag my mother into this. She knows nothing about the heist. Would you rather she hear about it from the kidnappers?
There's no reason for them to call her.
You're right. They won't call. When Jeffrey cracks under pressure and tells them where his money is, they'll just smash down her front door and put a gun to her head. Is that what you want?
God, no.
We need to find that money, hide it someplace else, and send your mother on a month-long vacation to Fiji. She leaned back and considered it.
All right,
she said, breathing out a heavy sigh. But let me be the one to break it to her. Now you're making sense, he said, as he backed out of the parking space. She shook her head, staring out the window.
None of this makes any sense,
she said under her breath.
Ay, Dios mío!
Reuben rolled his eyes as he walked into the kitchen to refresh the cold compress. His mother-in-law had not taken the news well. For 10 minutes, she'd been moaning, wailing, and calling for divine intervention. Savannah was beside her on the couch, trying in vain to console her.
Mi niño precioso!
Right. The precious boy whose idea of laying low was to spend 10 times retail on discontinued Rolexes and give them to strippers. Idiot.
Reuben, hurry!
Savannah called from the living room. He went to the freezer, wrapped fresh ice in the washcloth, and returned to the critical care unit, living room. His mother-in-law was on her back with her feet up on the couch and her head in Savannah's lap. Savannah took the compress and placed it on her mother's forehead. Beatrice Beauchamp was filled with more melodrama than the human body could possibly contain. Anything from the death of her husband to her parakeet's loss of appetite was enough to land her on the couch, praying to Saint Lazarus. Savannah had inherited her beautiful face, but nothing more. The rest of her, the carrying on, the 5-foot frame, the extra poundage, she'd passed on to her son. Reuben sat in the armchair facing them.
We need a plan to help Jeffrey, he said.
Sí, sí, el plan de Dios.
No, not God's plan. We need a plan. Savannah shot him an angry look.
Not now, Reuben.
This can't wait, he said, and then he spoke directly to his mother-in-law. Savannah and I have decided to pay the ransom.
Why not call the police?
Good question, but he was ready for it. The kidnappers said they will kill him if we call the police.
I know!
Totally agree. Ay-ya-ya-yada-yada-yada, but we need to come up with some money. Savannah patted her mother's forehead with the cloth.
How much?
Asked Beatrice.
A lot, said Reuben.
We think Jeffrey might have some cash around the house.
See, he won it in the lottery. Pick 6.
The lottery, huh? What a lucky boy, said Reuben. Do you know where he keeps it?
See, I found it when I cleaned his room, under his mattress.
Under the mattress. The thought of Jeffrey as his co-conspirator was suddenly enough to make Reuben want to shoot himself. I'll be right back. Reuben went down the hall. The door was closed but unlocked.
He went inside, not sure what disaster to expect, but the room was neat and tidy, just the way a doting Cuban mother would keep it. No coke mirrors on the dresser, no pornography on the walls, not so much as a hint of dust on the windowsill or nightstand. The bed was made with military precision. Reuben went straight to it and flipped the mattress. Benjamin Franklin was staring back at him through the vacuum-sealed packs. Reuben had marked each pack with a dollar value on the night of the divvy. Reuben did the quick math on Jeffrey's stash, gathered it up, and went back to the living room. 400,000, he said, as he laid the packs on the coffee table. Your brother burned through 1 million plus in 1 week.
That's not possible, said Savannah.
Add it up. She didn't bother.
Maybe he stashed more somewhere else.
What about it, Beatrice? Asked Reuben. Any more excellent hiding places besides the mattress?
Maybe. Ask el padrino, she said. I think Jeffrey gave some for him to hold.
Who's el padrino? Asked Reuben.
His godfather, said Savannah.
I know what el padrino means. Who is he?
Carlos Vasquez, said Savannah.
Where does he live?
No sé, said Beatrice. Jeffrey is the only one of the family who stays in touch with him. The rest of us, nah.
Should I even ask why?
He became a priest, said Beatrice.
You cut him off because he became a priest?
Savannah squeezed the excess water from the washcloth into the bucket at her feet, careful not to drop what remained of the ice cubes.
A Santeria priest.
Reuben had seen Santeria in Cuba, and it was still practiced in certain parts of the Afro-Cuban immigrant community in Miami. A Hialeah group had successfully defended the right to conduct animal sacrifices all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
To Reuben, the killing of chickens, doves, and turtles to provide nourishment that spirits needed to possess priests during rituals was more voodoo than religion. Jeffrey gave his money to a Santeria priest? He asked, incredulous.
For safekeeping, said Beatrice.
Reuben stared at the vacuum-sealed packs on the table. $400,000. If they added it to the $500,000 of Jeffrey's money that was buried in the yard, they were close to the ransom demand. But paying the full amount made about as much sense to Reuben as giving it to a Santeria priest.
Brilliant, said Reuben. Just brilliant.
Chapter 15. Savannah wanted lunch, but with $400,000 in the trunk of the car, Reuben refused to stop. He dropped her at the dry cleaners and drove straight home. Jeffrey's stash fit inside the leftover PVC pipe. He sealed it up, gave the liquid cement a minute to dry, and buried it in a foot of sand beneath the patio tiles in the backyard.
Under the mattress?
He gathered up his tools and shook the sand from his shoes.
You gotta be kidding me, Jeffrey.
Reuben put away the tools in the garage and went to the locked cabinet in the TV room. His gun collection was short one Makarov semi-automatic revolver, the Soviet Union standard military and police sidearm for 40 years, which Pinky had brandished at the airport warehouse, and which now lay at the bottom of the Miami River, never to be seen again. Reuben had other Russian weapons, but if he was going to lay low, it was best never to leave the house again with anything Russian-made. It seemed likely that at least one of those security guards had managed a good enough look at Pinky's Makarov to peg its origins. Plenty of non-Russian choices remained. He grabbed a Glock and one clip of standard 9mm ammunition and another clip of military-issue tracer ammo. It was overkill, but he was suddenly feeling the need to be prepared for anything.
It was time to visit El Padrino. Finding an address for Carlos Vasquez proved much easier than expected. Facebook apparently had no problem with Santeria priests, at least not the ones who had 18,000 likes and posted no photographs of animal sacrifice. Vasquez had no physical church. Services were held at his personal residence in Hialeah, and the Facebook comments and photos pointed Ruben to the exact house. It was less than 15 minutes away. Ruben left the crappy old car in his driveway and instead pulled the dusty tarp off of his motorcycle in the garage. The Kawasaki Ninja ZX14R was a precision machine that, in the eyes of most drivers, was nothing but a blur shooting by on the expressway. Long rides nowhere had been a therapy of sorts, until the accident. He hadn't ridden since. The ignition fired, but the engine didn't respond. Disuse and neglect beneath a dusty tarp had taken a toll. He tried again, and this time it answered with a roar. He rolled out of the garage and onto the street with a measure of caution, like a cowboy back on the horse that had thrown him. He observed the speed limit on the shady neighborhood streets, but as he approached the expressway, he felt the tug of the past, the need for speed. Halfway up the entrance ramp, he gunned it. Traffic was always heavy on the Palmetto Expressway, but he threaded his way between cars and around trucks as if they were cones on a test track, cutting the 15-minute ride in half. The power was addictive, and part of him wanted to keep going, but he forced himself to focus. He took the second Hialeah exit, worked the side streets east toward his destination, and parked in front of the ranch-style house. His heart was pounding as he climbed off the Kawasaki. The Vasquez residence was like thousands of other 60s vintage houses in Hialeah, a concrete shoebox with four cars parked in the front yard for the three families who shared 1,800 square feet of living space, three bedrooms and two baths. Ruben removed his helmet and started up the sidewalk. His escorts to the front door were a couple of chickens, clucking and blissfully unaware of their starring role in an upcoming Santeria ritual. Ruben rang the bell. An old man opened the door just far enough for the chain to catch. Ruben wasn't sure how to address a Santeria priest.
Father Carlos Vasquez?
Babalao Vasquez, he replied.
I'm Jeffrey Beauchamp's brother-in-law. The door slammed in his face. Ruben knocked again but got no answer. He walked toward the driveway and stopped. Parked alongside the house was a brand new Cadillac Eldorado. The temporary tag was still in the window. Ruben felt his anger rising. He went back to the front door and pounded hard enough to conjure up a host of Santeria spirits. Finally, Vasquez answered.
Did you take Jeffrey's money?
It was a demand, not a question.
No, señor. It was a gift to the church.
Yeah, I see the church needed a new Cadillac.
I pray every day for Jeffrey.
He needs his money back. He's in trouble.
Money doesn't solve trouble. Money makes trouble.
Then you'll be very happy to give it back. He chuckled and wagged a finger as he spoke.
Not today, señor.
Ruben leaned into the door before Vasquez could shut it, and he wedged his knee into the crack to make sure it stayed open.
Jeffrey needs his money.
The two men locked eyes through the opening, the taut chain between them. The old man made a strange, guttural sound that welled up from his belly and shook in his throat. Slowly it grew louder, but it had a rhythm to it, like some kind of chant.
Go,
he said.
I'm not leaving until I get Jeffrey's money. Go, or feel the wrath of the Orisha. I'm not... Ow!
Reuben shouted, pulling his leg from between the door and frame.
Orisha very angry now! Bullshit, Orisha! You just jabbed me with a fucking pen! Oh! All right, call the police! I'm dialing!
Vasquez said as he showed Reuben his cell phone. Then the door slammed. Reuben pounded on it.
Open the damn door! Police are coming!
Vasquez shouted from inside the house.
Lay low. It was getting harder and harder to follow his own rule, but hanging around for the police to arrive would have made him even stupider than Jeffrey.
He gave the door one good kick, letting Vasquez know that this wasn't over. Then he went to his motorcycle, put on his helmet, and rode away. Vasquez was a piece of shit, but he wasn't the problem. Jeffrey was the problem, and the $400,000 that Reuben had found under his mattress was well short of the solution. Reuben needed answers that didn't involve a Santeria priest who had the police on speed dial. He stopped for gas before getting back on the expressway. Half a tank would do it. He stepped away from the pumps to make a phone call before getting back on the bike. The last time he'd spoken to Savannah's uncle, Pinky had said he was getting out of town. Reuben took a shot and dialed his number. Pinky answered, and Reuben got right to the point.
Jeffrey's been kidnapped.
I know.
You know?
Yeah. He called me at 4 o'clock this morning to ask for money. He begged me to help him out. I told him, I'm your uncle, not your bank. Call your sister.
Pinky, the kidnappers want a ransom. This is serious.
Not my problem. Jeffrey got into this trouble. He can get out. If you and Savannah want to help him, be my guests.
I need Marco's share to pay the ransom.
Pinky laughed.
What's so funny? Asked Reuben.
Now I get it. You think I'm stupid? This has scam written all over it.
Scam? Pinky, you're making no sense.
Jeffrey gets kidnapped, and the first person he calls to pay a $1 million ransom is his uncle Pinky? Give me a break. He ain't kidnapped. This is you trying to scam me out of Marco's cut.
That's not true.
He called you first because he knew I'd kill him for getting into this mess.
Bullshit, Reuben. $1 million was exactly Marco's share. Like that's a coincidence. I'm out of here, you got that? I'm keeping Marco's money and I'm gone. Fuck all of you.
He hung up before Reuben could say another word. Reuben should have headed south, but he wasn't going home. He rode north toward I-75, a toll road that cut across the Everglades. He'd taken it all the way to Tampa before, one of many long rides on his motorcycle. This time, he wasn't going nearly that far. The day had started out badly and was only getting worse. Vasquez was scum, Pinky was no better, Ramsey was an idiot. Jeffrey was a problem with no solution. A $1 million ransom would be a band-aid at best. Times like these were all about self-preservation. Midday traffic on I-75 was nothing compared to South Florida's busiest throughways. Reuben was sharing 5 lanes with just a handful of cars, and he was feeling the tug of the past again, the need for speed. Not because he wanted to go back. He wanted to put it behind him, for good. The accident that had landed his motorcycle under a tarp in the garage had left him and his Kawasaki without a scratch. Savannah was another story. Reuben had buried the needle on his Kawasaki many times, but always while riding alone. Savannah was okay.